delighted. We're delighted to be playing Cream on a Friday afternoon, because that's what God put us on this planet to do. But also, there's a new project coming out called Cream Acoustic. It's a new album and documentary. It's launching this year. Here to tell me all about it, joining me live in the studio, is the man behind Cream Acoustic, Mark Waters. Mark, good afternoon to you.
Well, thank you very much. I very humbly say I'm one of the people behind Cream Acoustic, because it was very much a team effort. You know, we had Bruce Quarto, who is the head of Quarto Valley Records, who backed the whole thing. We've had Pete Brown, who, of course, co-wrote that song you just heard, I Feel Free. He executive produced and performed as an artist on the album and in the film. We've had Malcolm Bruce, Jack Bruce's son, a multi-instrumentalist, probably genius, playing on the film and the album. And you know, we've had Rob Cass, who produced and mixed the whole thing, and he's just incredible. So it's not just me. I just directed the film and got in all the musicians and the technicians' way.
Well, I mean, that's fair, is it? I mean, what is the concept then? Because I'm obviously Cream Acoustic, the original supergroup. I mean, we are now, what, 50-something years on from Cream. There's still a relevance, and there's still, I mean, for those who play music, either play it instruments or play it on the radio or produce, there is something about Cream that no other band perhaps has put together.
Yeah, so I mean, we've been trying to hash this out, and it's a question which comes up. And, you know, if you look at Ginger Baker, for example, he started as a jazz musician. That is a music which was brought over from Africa, well, and then developed in the United States, then came to Britain, then Ginger Baker, after Cream was together the first time around, went over to Africa, sort of changed his style to some degree, or added to his style, and then came back with that, and then played with Abbas Dodu on Cream Acoustic just in 2018, played with Abbas Dodu on Cream Acoustic, adding in those African beats into the Cream music. So it's the reason that it's still relevant is because it's so old. It goes back so far. The same with the blues element of it. The same with the Scottish folk music element of it. All those traditions go back so far, and that's why they're still relevant today.
I mean, rather than the Unplugged albums that we had, when we had a load of MTV Unplugged albums, we had the Nirvana, sure. We had Clapton, which you could say Layla relaunched a bit of his career in the early 90s. This isn't just playing the Cream tracks without the electric. This is actually sort of a reimagining then of them, is it?
Yeah, there's a reimagining of the tracks, most definitely. And also, there are some tracks which, for example, were destroyed before they ever made them on. Well, there's at least one which was destroyed before it ever made it onto a Cream album, which is Theme for an Imaginary Western, which, of course, Jack Bruce then subsequently recorded on a solo album, and which Mountain did a cover of. So Pete Brown performs that track, for example, on Cream Acoustic.
And what was it like? What's it like getting in touch with the musicians? I mean, as you said, the Ginger Baker, the late Ginger Baker, as we sadly now, as we said, Jack Bruce's son, and a certain Joe Bonamassa as well gets involved, and Bernie Martin, who I interviewed on the show a couple of weeks ago. I mean, what's it? Do you put the phone when you're putting this together? When they're putting this together, presumably people just leapt at the chance to be working with the musicians.
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of came together pretty organically. Of course, I mean, the only obstacle to yeah, you know, Bernie would like to play, or we'd like Bernie to play, and we'd like Joe to play. The only obstacle to these things, because people want to work together, obviously, great musicians want to work with each other, is the scheduling. So, for example, with Joe, we were lucky enough to get Joe into Abbey Road because he had a gig the night before. And it's funny, when we did the recordings with Joe in Abbey Road, he said, God, I think this is harder work than the gig was last night.
And what's it like, again, you casually drop in the studio you're working in? I mean, you don't get more legendary and better known than Abbey Road.
We're very lucky. I mean, we're just very fortunate, I think, to live in a time where that studio is still there. I know that a lot of studios have disappeared in London. And Abbey Road is the, it's, you know, it's got a certain aura to it, which, you know, you just can't put your finger on. There's something very, very special about the space, and something magical almost, something haunted, but in a good way.
So who was, how did you sort of schedule it? What was the timeline? Because you didn't just get them all in one day and say, right, you're going to do Sunshine of My Love, you're going to do I Feel Free. I mean, how, what were the logistics involved? And were you sort of filmed, because you think, did you think we're bringing these people together, so we're going to bring a documentary on? So was that bolted on, or was it a documentary and album, the two things separate and sort of merged, you know what I mean?
Well, that's a really good question, because basically at the beginning of the process, you know, we were kind of, we kind of hashed it out that we wanted something that would be a studio album, and on the film side would look some, would be not the same as, but reminiscent of the Unplugged series. And then, so with that concept we went in, but the problem with that is because of, not the problem, but some of the challenges that we faced as a result of that, because of modern studio techniques, were that Rob Cass, who is an absolutely fantastic producer and a very good friend of mine, had a certain way that he wanted to do things. Let's say you had three columns on a piece of paper. Rob had his vision. I had my vision. And that Rob's vision's on the left column, mine's on the right, and in the middle column you have the word impossible. and somehow we made it possible. I mean, and it's magic. It really is. I said to somebody, I said, I won't be ashamed of this in 15 years' time. And I did watch The Last Waltz over and over and over and over again while I was directing this film.
Because it is, I mean, there is a long history of it's a very difficult thing to get, because it's one art form trying to capture another art form. And especially when you've got legendary players like Joe, like, you know, like Bernie in a room, it's very difficult to get that immediacy. I mean, people will say, oh, you should watch this concert video because it's really good. And then you see the concert video and you just think, I mean, with the exception of things like, you know, Woodstock or The Last Waltz, there are very few films that capture, you know, the raw energy of a music performance.
I think it's really important to love the music as a filmmaker. If you're making a music documentary, I think it's important to have some veneer of understanding when it comes to the what to film when. I mean, you look at the old 60s stuff of Hendrix, and you know, Hendrix is doing an amazing solo and they're filming his face, and that's a travesty. And so, you know, the main thing is to walk out of it not committing a terrible crime to humanity by not revealing precisely what these guys were playing, to be, I don't know, a little bit academic about it almost.
I mean, how many cameras did you have? People, were you following him around with the steady camera at all times? I mean, how many cameras did you have during the thing? I mean, is it a handheld camera job? Is it a mixture? Is it a mezcla of the two? I mean, what?
We had handheld cameras. We had, I'm not sure how many cameras we had. I can't remember exactly because it changed from session to session.
Sure.
But we had handheld cameras. We had cameras on Dolly and tracks. We had a camera on a crane and movie rig. So it's a whole mixture of things, because you want to try. We had a special camera on Ginger, which was above his drums.
Right.
I nicknamed it the Ginger Cam, because it only filmed Ginger on the drums from above. So, because Ginger, like the way that he would play, if you saw it from the front, and you didn't quite have it framed properly, so you didn't see the impact of the stick hitting the skins on the drums, you'd think that's not real, because his style was so unusual, and it was almost like, it was almost superhuman the way he was playing. The way that he plays, it's faster than the camera. You look at the stuff even going back to the Cream Farewell, mm-hmm, concerts where they filmed
the Royal Albert Hall concerts.
Yeah, where Tony Palmer, who I had the pleasure of meeting recently, where he filmed those concerts. You look at when he's filming Ginger, and sometimes you just like, no, that's, it's the camera's not picking up the movement of his hands because he's too fast, you know.
And what was Ginger like to? Because he had a reputation. I mean, you say you got the Ginger cam above him because that was probably out of the line of fire as well.
Well, no, I mean Ginger. I don't want to perpetuate this, this impression that people had of Ginger. Yes, it's true. Ginger did not suffer fools, but most intelligent artists don't suffer fools. I don't think Eric Clapton, who I've interviewed, I don't think Eric Clapton would have suffered me as a fool if I'd gone in and asked him stupid questions when I interviewed him. I don't think Jack Bruce would have suffered me either. But I'm not a fool. And Ginger was very nice to me always, very polite and very professional. So I know that some people got the sharp end of his tongue, as they did the sharp end of Jack's tongue sometimes as well. But I don't think that was sort of a standard default position of either of those men. If you approach things in a professional manner, they're going to treat you well. They're going to respect you.
Yeah. Was Eric Clapton approached for this project? Did he know about it? Was it scheduling, or how did he get in?
Yeah, he was preparing for a tour. So I mean, that's what he said. So he wasn't able to record on this project, and obviously Jack has gone a few years now. Malcolm played multiple instruments on the album. I mean, he played piano. He sings. He plays guitar and he plays bass. He plays a storm on Deserted Cities of the Heart. And he's soloing at the same time as Joe Bonamassa. So Joe Bonamassa is soloing on guitar, and Malcolm's soloing on the bass. And it's just absolutely mind blowing.
What's it like? You're standing there, you're getting yourself set up in Abbey Road, and you've got Joe Bonamassa there, you've got Malcolm sort of just getting ready in the bass, you've got Ginger Baker perhaps doing something in the corner, and you just think, I'm in the presence of greatness here, basically, and I hope my machinery works correctly.
Well, first of all, it would be very frightening if I was still setting up when Joe Bonamassa and other musicians are in the studio, because that would mean I'd be really behind my work. Film crews tend to get there really early in the morning. We tend to be set up by the time everyone comes in. There are very few moments when you're directing something where you have enough time, for me anyway, where I have enough time to consider what is happening is magic, but there are a few moments where I knew everything was working. I knew all the cameras in the right place. I knew everything was going well. And I was able to step back. And one of those moments was when Ginger plays this with Abbas Dodu, plays this amazing rhythm part in the middle of the song Sweet Wine. And I just thought, this is history. This is history making stuff, because it's totally different to any other version of that song that I've heard. I haven't heard an Air Force version of that song, which sounds like that. I hadn't heard a Cream version of that song that sounds like that. It was just something completely different, and it was improvised, and it was mind blowing.
And of course, Ginger is no longer with us, so that obviously adds poignancy to both the album and the documentary.
Yeah, unfortunately, Ginger left us last year. That's true. Of course, we are coming to a point where, as you said, it's 50 years on from when these things were recorded. We're 50 years on from a cultural renaissance in the West. I don't think it's a renaissance which is dead yet. I think we're still continuing. We're still progressing artistically. We're still creating new things. Certainly in music and in film, and technology is allowing us to do that. But this was the foundation of all that. And as you said, this was the first supergroup. And my gosh, would you have had the Jimi Hendrix experience without Cream? Would you have had, years and years later, a trio like Nirvana without Cream? you know, it's just, it's a very special time right now. And it's a time where really what we're doing is we're ingraining these traditions of songs into the culture in the same way that our forefathers ingrained folk music into the culture, which lasted hundreds of years. And I think that the music of Cream is still going to be around in 200 years' time.
I mean, the thing with Cream is it's sometimes with supergroups, you'd have two at the front, and then you get the you get two superstars and a couple others in the background. But with Cream, you had the three performers at the top of their game at the top of the time, and that's what makes Cream particularly special.
You know, it's interesting. I'm not sure that they were on the top of their game when Cream was happening. I think, you know, that artists develop, and I think that they were certainly perhaps at the top of their fame.
Yeah, but you wouldn't say that, you know, Jack Bruce was carrying Clapton or Baker was carrying Bruce, would you?
No.
No, exactly.
No.
That's kind of what I meant.
In
terms of fame, I'm saying equal musicianship in terms of that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I believe the story goes, and I'm probably paraphrasing somebody who's paraphrasing this at this stage, but I believe the story goes that Jack and Ginger told Eric, oh, this is a blues band, and then sort of scammed him into playing jazz.
So tell me where are we then in terms of the documentary, because you said you're currently editing.
The documentary is edited.
Right.
I just did the final pass on post-production sound.
Right.
This week, which is why I'm a bit knackered, because I've been watching the film over and over and over again and making notes. And thank you, 0101, and thank you, Eric Moore, for working so damn hard on this. It really, really appreciate it. We're just doing a little bit of grading at the moment, a little bit of color grading. And then it will go into a DVD format very soon, and it will be distributed this year. I think it's going to be distributed, from what I understand, and this is grapevine, but I understand it's going to be distributed through Proper Records,
right,
in the UK. I'm not sure who the distributor is in the United States, but I know there is one. And it's going to be released in hard copy format to begin with. So it's going to be released on DVD. The album is going to be released initially on vinyl.
Wow. Okay. Keeping it back to the original. That is exactly what they would have wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's what we want.
Yeah. Because there's been a huge revival in vinyl, which has been...
Well, Pete is over the moon about it. Pete's been saying to me, man, you know, can you get me the final cut of the film over so I can write the liner notes? I just really want to see it. And he's seen sections of it because he's been involved, because Pete and I have a film company together, and I involve him as much as possible,
yeah,
in all the creative processes. But he hasn't seen the whole thing yet, just stuck together. So he's getting kind of excited. So I'll get it to you, man. Pete, it's coming next week.
Any chance of a 16mm print then? Or is that too much to ask?
There's a guy in London who, if I put that to Daya Dodds, if you're listening, who, if I put that to, might find some way of reversing the digital into celluloid. He's a pretty interesting guy when it comes to the celluloid stuff. He's keeping it alive.
So what was your favorite? What is your favorite moment, or the moment you'll take from this whole project, Cream Acoustic, then?
My favorite memory from
Cream. Or your most infamous memory, or the thing that will stick to you. When people say in 10 years' time, when you picked up all the awards and the accolades for the film, what will you remember from Cream? Would it be the setting up in an Abbey Road? Was the first time, you know, Ginger walked in? Is it Joe Bonamassa? Is it Bernie Marsden?
I think it was Joe Bonamassa shouting at me. I think that was pretty really? Funny. Yeah, yeah, I quite enjoyed that, maybe because I'm a masochist. But no. You know, that's just the sort of the creative process sometimes. I think he asked me if I was crazy because of one directing decision I was making.
And so, obviously we can say
I am. Yes, I'm completely insane. It's
true. Can I just say, I do like the shirt today, by the way. It works perfectly for radio.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, it matches
it
your acoustical
actually,
treatment.
Yes, it doesn't, it doesn't.
I had somebody come and do a recce of your office beforehand, and I wanted to make sure that
that's
I could blend into the and the furnishings.
That's the sort of professionalism which has made you such a legend. And also, thank you so much for coming to talk to us today about Cream Acoustic. Mark, if people want to find out more about you or about the project,
go to the Facebook page, Brown Waters.
Yep.
And also check out Pete Brown's Facebook page, Pete Brown.
Super. Well, Mark, the film is called Cream Acoustic. The album is called Cream Acoustic. Can't wait to see it. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. Have a nice day.